once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
And we are, now that we've said our names, we always have this little blank. What are we supposed to do again?
Now, what are we supposed to do now?
We're supposed to do some kind of a program here on the economy. This is The Personal Wealth Coach. And hopefully today we'll be enlightening you with things about finance, or maybe more likely befuddling you with the complexity of the world that we live in. Hopefully we can enlighten more than befuddle, but often what we wind up with is befuddlightenment there. So
it's beflightenment.
Beflightenment. Right. So before we get started, though, we have to disclose some things. The Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm. Why are we telling you that? Because we fall under some different regulations. It's registered with the SEC as an investment advisory firm. That means fiduciary advice given and so on. We don't give fiduciary advice on the air. We can't. It's not private. We don't know all of you. We can't custom tailor our advice to you. Even if you're sending us an email, it wouldn't be private for us to answer it on the air. So we give educational information while we're on here, and I think that's pretty important to know. Just because the SEC is who the firm registers with to be a fiduciary doesn't mean that the SEC likes us or dislikes us. It doesn't imply that the SEC has any feelings at all. In fact, I don't think they have feelings. I think they're pretty unfeeling out there. They are a government agency. If it's not in triplicate, it doesn't exist.
I think they feel untrusting.
Yes, and that's their role. I mean, they're supposed to be untrusting. So
right,
we got to say that, and it's important for you to understand. And now, would you deem to tell us the next disclosure?
The information that we use in this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information.
Or especially unsaid information. The accuracy and completeness of unsaid information is strictly not guaranteed.
I will guarantee that unsaid information has not been said.
Oh, wow. I see what you did there.
It is not complete.
Right.
I will guarantee the incompleteness of unsaid information.
But what about if we type it?
On the radio?
Yeah, it's very, very new media. It's this is going to be Web 4.0.
Oh, I thought it was...
It's called WebEx. Actually moving backwards. It's the telegraph.
Oh, yeah. Or teletype.
Yeah. So we could do it. We also don't pay for this time on the station. We are also not paid for the time. This is not a paid commercial program. The firm advertises about the radio program, but that's it. The studio also advertises about the radio program. There is no quid pro quo, Senator. In fact, I think if we said we were going to stop doing the radio program, I don't know that it would go over so well at the studio. I think they would not like that for some reason. I might be wrong. I mean, I haven't talked to them about it in a long time. So I think they like us still. So what happened this week in the market?
Something happened in the market this week?
Yeah, we started the week...
On Monday.
With a Monday. But the problem was that the market was all confused. It didn't want to start the week on a Monday. So it didn't. We skipped it.
It was weird. It was.
We had a four-day week in the market, even though the week is very clearly on the calendar with 7 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, the stock market, if we mean the S&P 500 stock index, affectionately known as SPX to its friends and neighbors, rose 1.94% to 38.99.38, which is not bad. It's still down about 18% this year. It's down 10.76% from this time last year. However, if we look back 3 years, and that is the shortest period of time I would consider an investment to be an investment, it's up about 28% or about 8.44% a year.
That so sounds really horrible. Horrible.
It's not up in bad shape at all.
Right.
It's 8.44% a year in the environment we've had in the last 3 years, I think is pretty good. And I just saw a typo in our newsletter that we all missed. We actually said our other follow-up index. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index declined 0.10% for the week to 2263.76. Yeah, okay. And it's down 12.84% this year and 7.33% for the last 12 months, which tells you that value stocks are doing, over the last 12 months, have done better than growth stocks as a group, and smaller stocks have done better than large stocks since at least recently. Okay, mid-cap stocks anyway.
And just as a quick, there isn't a typo in the newsletter. I'm looking at it right now. It says our other followed index.
Oh, wow.
So you have a typo in an early version or something. I don't know.
It's funny because it disappeared as I moved the PDF around. Anyway.
Oh, that's autocorrect for you.
Yeah. Anyway, the 10-year U.S. Treasury did something interesting that actually makes a lot of sense if you follow this stuff. It is sitting at 3.078%. It's been up considerably higher than that. It's been down lower than that. It's wobbling around up and down. And there's a whole, I could talk a lot about that, and I probably will if we get enough time. The Treasury yield curve, and this made a lot of headlines, but so far is not significant. The Treasury yield curve from 2 years to 10 years is very, very, very slightly negative, meaning that the 10-year yield is 3.078, and the 2-year note is yielding 3.115. So that means the 2-year interest rate on Treasuries is very slightly higher than the 10-year yield, which is an inversion. It's not much of an inversion. Now, if it goes on for 2 more weeks and it gets worse, then there is a fairly high probability that some form of recession is on the horizon someplace as much as 18 months out. So the 30-year bond, on the other hand, remaining on the positive side of the slope, it's up at 3.251. West Texas Intermediate crude oil, yay, dropped a little more. It's at 104.86.
This is
$104.86 a barrel.
The majority of people cheer when crude oil drops and don't cheer when the stock market drops.
That's because they don't burn stocks in their car.
I hope not, but maybe
they could.
But maybe we could do that, especially since they don't issue certificates anymore, just be the electronic stuff being burned. So
in a sense, you can. You can liquidate some stocks, use the dollars you got from liquidating the stocks to buy gasoline and burn the gasoline.
Right.
That's cool. All right. That's pretty much it. Gas prices are down a bit, as people have noticed, which is why I was going yay, because people are driving less. We're using about 13% gasoline than we were a couple of years ago.
13% less gasoline?
In June.
Yeah.
Diesel and gasoline. Well, diesel is still being used a lot, but what we've seen is recreational use, meaning people who are just driving places because they want to drive places has fallen, which is, by the way, absolutely normal.
I'm a recreational user of gasoline. I'll let you know that right now.
All right. Well, as long as we don't pass a law against it. You know, you get pulled over and said, "Do you have any gasoline?" Oh, he's got gasoline. Take him to jail.
No, I'm a professional user. Don't worry.
Anyway, we're using in June. And going into the July 4th weekend, we apparently, as a nation, used significantly about 13% less gasoline than we used in 2019. It was three years ago now. It's hard to imagine.
Pre-pandemic, we used a lot less gasoline in 2020. But that's because a lot of people weren't driving at all for big chunks of that time period.
I heard pre-pandemic referred to as BC the other day, before COVID.
Before COVID?
Yeah, so the history of the world is now divided into BC
AD,
and AC.
Wait, and CE and BCE.
Well, BCE, that's too long ago. Nobody remembers that. People say BC now, they mean before COVID, not before Christ.
Calendars all worked backward back then anyway. So, yeah. All right. So we have some questions.
Right. The first one is, what is the meaning of life, the universe, and everything?
It is not. That would be a wonderful question to receive, but we may have to think about it for quite a long time. We might have to outsource this to a planet and maybe some white mice. We'll see.
Right.
However, his questions are nearly on the level of that significance. His first question is a question that we really appreciate. So, Inquisitor John, the most faithful of our inquisitors, the guy who's asked us probably more questions on the air than any other listener combined throughout the years that we've been doing this. We appreciate you, John. He's, as is tradition, taken a picture of the Wall Street Journal in its paper form and emailed it to us digitally so that we may compare the digital versus the converted analog to digital to see which is more accurate. He's got a question, and in ink, he has circled parts of an article. The article is about the money supply. It's about money in general. His question is, his statement is, creating money, when did this system start, and is it unique to the U.S.? So the area he's got circled, this is an opinion piece, but this portion of it is based in good fact. So we'll say that first. When a bank makes a loan, it credits the borrower's deposit account. The loan does not come from the bank drawing down on its reserves at the Fed. Banks can also create money by... Okay, so let me explain that, because that's... Man, that's dry. Let's give an example. You have $10,000 and you deposit it at the bank. What's the bank going to do with that money? They're supposed to hold it for you, right? And make sure that it's there when you come back. But they don't make any money doing that. And they actually do like to be profitable. So they loan some percentage of that out. It's coming from your deposit. And the Federal Reserve and the Federal Reserve Act are set to tell the bank what percentage of their deposits they're allowed to loan out. Because we don't want you to be showing up for your money and them not to have it because they loaned it all out. There's a great scene in It's a Wonderful Life, every Christmas classic, where Jimmy Stewart is standing on the countertop at the savings and loan telling people that the money's not there, which you would think would be a bad speech to give to the depositors. But he says, it's not here. It's in so-and-so's house, and it's in so-and-so's house. So he gave mortgages out with that money. This is a key piece of information. What does it have to do with creating money? Well, if you put $10,000 in the bank and the bank loans out some portion of that, let's say they make $10 off the interest. That would be ludicrous these days, but we're trying to keep this even and easy. They made $10 off of loaning that money out. Now, your deposit is there and you show up and you get your money out. You pulled out your $10,000. The bank still has $10. Where did it come from? And I know that's a mass and grossly oversimplified, but in essence, a big chunk of that $10 is money that didn't exist before. It wasn't in paper form. It's an electronic form. And let's just say, for instance, you take the loan from the bank. You give them $10,000 and then you get a loan of $2,000 and you pay them $10 and then you pay off the loan and you withdraw your $10,000. Where did that extra $10 come from? Well, you may have done something with the loan to create some value. It may have allowed you to buy a car so you could go to work. Therefore, you've created value in the economy, and that is represented by the interest payment. That's new money. Now, it's not 100% new money. The reverse is also true, and we saw this very directly in the Great Recession, the global financial crisis. When money is loaned out and then not repaid, it causes money to disappear, just like paying money back with interest causes money to appear. When loans are not repaid, though, the amount of money that's created is a lot more than the amount of, or destroyed, I'm sorry, the amount of money that's destroyed when it's not paid back. Could be a massive portion of the loan. It's just gone. The money was deleted. It's not in the system anymore. And that obviously can affect a bank negatively. So when did that start is the next part of his question, and is it unique to the United States? You have something you want to add at this point, though.
Well, I wanted to give an example that I think people can relate to right now. If you bought a crypto coin, what's a good number? When they were above 100, some of them were above 100,000 at one point.
We'll
right?
Let's say the 69,000 Bitcoin. That's at its close to.
I want a round figure here. Let's say you bought Bitcoin at 50,000.
Okay. 50,000.
And it's now at 30,000.
It's actually more like 19,000, but that's okay.
Okay, let's make it 20,000.
Okay.
50,000, 20,000. And you paid $50,000, which went to somebody who sold you the Bitcoin. But from your perspective, if you sold it at $20,000, $30,000 just disappeared. It's no longer previously on your books, and effectively, when you think about your wealth, liquid wealth that you can liquidate to spend, you just had $30,000 disappear. Now, admittedly, the total amount of money that you pay, this is where it gets complex.
Yeah, if it wasn't enough already.
You paid $50,000 to someone, but let's just talk about your loss of $30,000. Let's just say that was all of your savings, or most of your savings. And you had $50,000 in savings, and now you have $20,000 in savings and feel very, very uncomfortable because you've only got $20,000 in savings. That means that something you were thinking about buying, like a new couch or something, you may not buy.
So that's slowing down growth in the economy there.
It's slowing down the velocity of money. Money does two things. One, Jake was talking about the fact that it gets multiplied literally by banks as they make loans. It also is affected by how fast it's moving around. When people stick it in savings and don't do anything with it, when they put it under their bed or whatever, it slows down the growth of money and can actually cause it to go backwards, which is sort of interesting. As people pull money out of the economy, prices then tend to drop to get them to spend the money. As prices drop, the profits of corporations drop. They start laying people off, so those people are no longer able to sell something they have, their time. So there's less money in society, and that's the way the whole thing works. And the other thing, it goes the other way, too. When people start being hired and companies have record profitability, more money starts to appear in the economy. It's the Federal Reserve's job to control both the velocity and the quantity of money to match what's going on in the economy.
And what does that mean? Well, if you're making one chair a day and you're selling that chair and you're making pretty good profit on that, you're not raising the price on it, and then you make two chairs a day, you've doubled your income, but it's because you've doubled your productivity. You're still creating something of value that's the same. If you just start raising the price of your chair and you haven't been more productive, you're not making more chairs, the chair is not fancier in any way, it's the same chair, that's inflationary. So the Federal Reserve has to look and see when value is actually being created, what the productivity rate is versus what the money creation rate is. And they're trying to get those two to match. Okay. So, and if you look back in a long-term average of productivity increase over the last 40 years or so, it's about 2.5%. It's not that surprising.
Per year. Right.
So it's not that surprising that the Federal Reserve's target for inflation is 2.5%. They just need to have enough money being created to bring that. Now, when did we start doing this? This actually will make it easier to understand. This started when we first started using paper to represent value. The first checks came out of the Dutch banks, but the Italian banks picked it up really fast. And the Italian banks at that point were dominated by one family, the Medicis. They were originally based in Florence, they went to Venice, and then they basically went everywhere. They are the ones that funded Michelangelo, Donatello, all of the turtles were funded by the Medici. So
there is probably some truth in that, what you just said, because when the Ninja Turtles started up, it probably required a loan.
Could be, yeah.
From a bank.
So why were they using paper money? Well, if you knew how much gold you had at the bank and at another branch of the bank, and gold's not always what they were using. A lot of times they were using candlesticks. Sometimes they were using coins of different denominations from different countries that had very strange exchange rates. Very odd. So they were really looking at the weight of the metal rather than what kind of coin it was. The preferred coin at that point was the doubloon, the pieces of eight, the Spanish money, because it was very pure, because they had a source of gold in the New World. Okay, so the Italians, the Medicis, start recognizing how much money they have at each bank. They used a very new form of technology, which allowed them to be so successful that they did fund all of the turtles, and that was double entry bookkeeping. And now it's that doesn't sound very exciting or sexy today, but
it's very arcane. It has something to do with the Illuminati.
Right. It funded the Renaissance. So now you have the bank saying, hey, if this is a letter of credit, this is how it first started, and we will check against your balance so that you can receive the value of this letter of credit. That was the check. And it was written out by the bank. People didn't write their own checks. The bank would write it for them because the bank needed to know that the balance was in their bank before handing it out.
Banks still write checks.
Yes, they do. They do.
They're called cashier's checks.
Right, exactly. And they are good as money. So they have not changed that aspect. When they show up, if you lose that letter of credit, too bad. It's gone. Because somebody else could show up with that letter of credit and spend it. Just because you lost it doesn't mean that it's gone forever. It's just gone from you.
Could I add one thing?
Yeah.
If you open up your wallet and you see a dollar bill in it, it is a letter of credit.
That's right.
From the Treasury. Actually, it's not from the Treasury of the United States. It's from a bank.
Yeah, the Federal Reserve Bank. It says Federal Reserve note right at the top of it.
It will even tell you somewhere on there which of the Federal Reserve banks issued that note.
This is a cashier's check based on the Federal Reserve. When you have letters of credit available, it means that it's up to the bank then to decide how much actual money they have and how much they're giving out. There have been quite a lot of times in the past during this time period where the Medicis had a lot more loans out than they had metal to back it up with. Banks still do that, and sometimes it comes back and bites them. It's really what's happening in the crypto world right now. All the collapses are based on these big crypto firms loaning each other crypto assets, and that firm then loaning it to someone else, and then the collateral that was put on to back up the loan is also loaned out again. So this is a problem. It's a kind of banking issue, but this is how money was created. As soon as a bank could say, I have this on deposit, you can spend this money, and there was not a direct link to the gold or the silver that they had in their bank accounts, this is when money started being created when loans were made. It's not unique to the United States. It's everywhere.
And there's a name for that. It's called fractional reserve banking.
Right.
Federal Reserve tells the banks, you have money on deposit. You must have loans no greater than this much based on the money you have on deposit. In essence, for instance, they could say, you must have an 8% of everything you've loaned must be on deposit at the bank. Whoa, what a small number. But that's the way it really works. And that means that if people come in and say, I want my money out of my bank account right now, they can actually pay out about 8% of the unplanned withdrawals. Now, if a certificate deposit is in there, your planned withdrawal, let's say you have a one-year CD, they have a planned withdrawal 1 year out.
The current number right now set by the Federal Reserve for any bank doing business with the Federal Reserve banks is 10%. It's the marginal reserve requirement, and it's 10% of the bank's demand and checking deposits. Anything that you could show up and just say, give me that money right now in a normal loan, that's called a callable loan, they have to have 10% of that available, because about 10% of you probably will over the course of a year. Most people don't empty their whole bank out during the year.
And if you go beyond the 10%, let's say a bank has, let's make a really small bank, and it only has $1,000. Let's say that means they have to have a reserve of $100. Okay, so people show up and they want more than $100. How does the bank provide them with extra money? And the answer is that's what the Federal Reserve is for, and that's why it's called a reserve. They contact the Federal Reserve and says, we need more money. We need to borrow the money from you, from the Federal Reserve, to pay our depositors who want to take some money out.
And
the Federal Reserve coughs up the money very quickly.
Conversely, a bank may put 10% of their deposits at the Federal Reserve as their reserve to prove that they have 10% in reserve, they put it at the Federal Reserve. That's why it's called that.
And the Federal Reserve then pays them interest on it, which is the bank rate that they set.
That's the number that goes up and down when they are changing the rates at the Federal Open Market Committee.
Does this sound complicated?
It does. It does actually.
It is complicated.
And I can tell you that the Federal Reserve System is based on a system that was developed in England, the Bank of England. And a big chunk of that was written by Sir Isaac Newton, who, by the way, if he had been alive and done the same sort of things at a time when the Nobel Prize were being given out, he would have gotten it in biology, in economics, and in physics. Maybe in mathematics as well. That's a different prize. It's not, Nobel Prize doesn't give one for mathematics, but he probably would have gotten all of those prizes too. Interesting fellow, that Newton guy. And he still wound up losing a big fortune in the stock market. That's a different story. We have another question, though. I think we've gotten that one pretty well.
Well, we could actually go on for a full master's degree not even begin to understand it.
We have a follow-up question on the one we were working on. Does forgiving student loans destroy money? No, it's the opposite.
It creates money.
When you forgive a loan, it's income. Just ask the IRS. Just one of the things about student loan forgiveness is they have to be really careful, because the IRS will say, you are a low-paid school administrator with two master's degrees, otherwise you wouldn't be able to get the job, but you're low-paid and you have $250,000 in student loans outstanding. We're going to forgive that. And the IRS goes, you made $250,000 plus the money you made at your low-paid job. You made $280,000. You owe 37% of that today.
Well, it doesn't actually work that way. It's in the 37% bracket.
Right. So now you're in the 37% bracket, but it includes all that extra income. Mm. Well, the student loan forgiveness has been tweaked enough now that doesn't happen, but it was a really big problem for a while. So even the IRS considers that new money in the system. Basically, if you buy a car, you gave the money to someone to buy that car, even if you got it as a loan, then you're expected to pay it back. And the creation of the money is the interest payment that you're making on top of the principal. That's new stuff being made. When that loan is forgiven, all of that money becomes new stuff. The government just says, here, it's kind of like a stimulus package based on a loan, which is where the government got the money to do the stimulus packages, is that a lot of people bought bonds, gave them loans with that bond, then they turned and put it out into the economy. And we look at the inflation rate and we look at the money supply. We can see the money supply is really high. We probably wouldn't have crazy runaway inflation if our money supply was still at the same level as it was in 2019. I just said something that is very controversial. Let me add to that. But that's kind of like saying we wouldn't be going very fast in this race car if one of the tires wasn't on it. There are a lot of reasons for inflation, and one tire on a race car would have prevented it from going fast, but there are lots of other reasons why it's going faster than the other race cars.
I want to point out here that Moody's did a very careful deconstruction of inflation, and of the 8.6% CPI that we had last month, 1/10 of 1 point, 0.1% inflation was due to the stimulus money.
Correct. So this is the point that I'm making. The speed of the race car has a tiny percentage of that speed due from having the tire. That tire is not the in any way, shape, or form the only reason why that race car is going fast. If you put it as a percentage of the reason why the race car is going fast, it is tiny. But the race car couldn't go fast without the tire. You need to have extra money in the system to get inflation. But it's not the cause of inflation. It's the momentum of that money moving around that causes inflation, and people are still sitting on that money. It's still sitting in bank accounts. It's starting to get tapped now that inflation is getting so big. But the money supply is still staggeringly large. If that were the reason for inflation, it would be spent already. Profits would have been coming out of that. We would see it in reinvestment and business and so on. We're not seeing that. The money supply hasn't come down very far at all. So all of that is, when you forgive loans, you're creating money, because both the college received money when you paid for the education, and you received the value of the education, which is causing you to hopefully go out and make some kind of a good income in your life. And then the federal government just saying you don't owe anything for it, that's free money. It's money that didn't exist before. The reality of free money is that it's new. Stimulus money was new money. So it isn't the reason for inflation any more than the car tire is the reason for winning the race. It's part of it, though.
And one of the reasons the money supply is up, and I certainly agree with you that the money supply is more than doubled since the pandemic.
2019, yeah.
But the prime reason we have a large money supply, remember we said that the government doesn't really create money.
That's right. That is absolutely correct.
It can hand out a little bit of money, but in light of the fact that, for example, we're talking about the money supply being $22 trillion, the liquid money supply in the United States right now. I think that's the number. So why is it so high then if the government didn't give it out? That's the M1. Yeah, M1 right now is $20,632,000,000,000. If you go to M0 or M2, it gets bigger.
Yeah, M2 is my preferred number. I've got the M2s up here. We're at 21,754 billion dollars in circulation.
Right.
Versus March, or let's say November, December 2019, it was 15.
But so we got M0,
$7 trillion more hanging out there. It's a 50% increase.
And if you go to M0, which takes all of that into account, it's $559 trillion, which is absurd. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
It is the lowering of interest rates that allowed banks that caused people to go to the bank or go to the bond market. Mm-hmm. As Apple did, as Microsoft did. Apple and Microsoft, for example, really didn't need to borrow any money.
The 100-year Apple loan that they took at dirt cheap interest rates, that's like one of the smartest things they could have done. I mean, inflation is going to be higher than that for the 100 years that they have it.
And that's why they did it. They went, their credit was good, so they went to the market and they borrowed billions and billions and billions of dollars and paying less interest rate on it than inflation, which means that whoever loaned them the money is paying them to have borrowed the money.
Right. Now,
which is absurd, but that's the way it works.
We've just covered a bunch of stuff and said that the government almost never creates money. We, in the stimulus, if you had a Paycheck Protection Program loan that was forgiven, that was a loan that was forgiven. So that was new money, and it was based on a congressional act. It went through the SBA, which was a congressional organization, and the money was borrowed to pay for that by the U.S. government. So we have a lot of money that came from stimulus. We have a lot of money that came from easy money loans that were either forgiven or extremely low interest rates were charged on them and inflation was running higher. So forgiving loans doesn't destroy money. It adds more money to the system. It causes inflation because if you think of it from a very simple, very, very micro perspective, you're the teacher. You're teaching kindergarten algebra, and which has to do with sippy cups, I think. So you have a $400 a month student loan that you're paying. It's forgiven. What are you going to do with that $400 a month now? Well, you may save some of it. That'd be really great. You might invest some of it. That'd be really great. Unfortunately, most people spend it. And that is new money in the system that was going toward paying off a loan that doesn't have to be paid off. It's new money, in essence. It isn't obligated to do something else. So it is inflationary, just only in the fact that it's generally being forgiven for people that are most likely to spend it. If you're more likely to spend it, it adds to the momentum of the money. That if you're spending it, it causes people to say, hey, I don't have enough stuff to sell. I need to raise my prices. If you're saving it, nobody raises their prices over it. They don't know what you have in the bank, but you know you have it there for a rainy day. That's not inflationary. That's where the momentum is. If it's moving around, that causes inflation. If it's just sitting there in deposit, it's not inflationary.
Which is good physics, but we need to break for commercials.
Yes, we do. We have commercials we need to play. If you'd like to join the conversation, the email addresses in here are jeff@tpwc.com and jake@tpwc.com. We've got another question before the end of the hour to answer about what's controllable and what's not in a bear market. And we'll be back on the other side of these very important announcements from our sponsor. And we're back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and
Jeff McClure.
We are here to bring you information, befuddle your brains, talk about the creation and destruction of money. It's as if that's a cool conversation. It's creation. And you would think there's like lasers and explosions and stuff. And just destruction of money. No, it's just somebody defaulted on a loan.
And one of the big questions is, what is money? And there's a lot of answers to that. The answer that I prefer is, it is a representation of value with which you can buy things that other people have that you want.
Yeah.
And which of course you will then accept from other people to give them things that you have that they want. For example, if you are employed and you work during the day and you're paid by the hour,
what about
your employer?
What about at night? Can you work during the night too?
This is the metaphorical day that includes 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Right. This is the military day.
Okay.
As opposed to the civilian day. The day needs to be defined too, because it's like 14 days long, the daylight on this moon. So if you're on the moon, how long is a day?
Yeah, that's a good question. On the planet Earth, we have a 24-hour day. Okay, good.
More or less.
So yes. We're just not only establishing what money is, but also what a day is. So go ahead.
Right. What a difference a day makes.
Yes.
So what happens is you have a certain amount of hours that belong to you because you're in a society where the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence says you own your time. You can forfeit it, but you own it. But you then contract with somebody to sell your time to them. Your time multiplied times your talent. And they buy it from you, and they use something that you can then turn around and buy other things with, like food and shelter and clothing and gasoline to put in your vehicle, or if you use gasoline or electricity to put in your vehicle, whatever you put in your vehicle, that's money. It is a representation of value used as an exchange device. It also, this is where it starts to get
hopefully
interesting.
Very portable. That's the...
Right. Well, portable and... easily preserved. Chickens make pretty good money. You can hold them upside down by their feet, and they will be quite docile. Yeah, they'll be quiet, and you can use them as money. It just, the point is, the deflationary issues around chickens are pretty intense, because if you hold them long enough upside down like that, then they become worthless.
Yeah, and it's really hard to carry enough chickens
To buy a car.
I was going to say a car, but a cow as well. I mean, if you're going to go buy a car, it is more difficult to buy, and you have to have some kind of a loading device to fill up a lot of big trucks full of chickens mm-hmm. to go and buy that car. So you need something more portable.
You can exchange them for cows.
Yeah. That's
because it takes fewer cows to buy a car, but the weight exchange ratio there gets kind of goofy.
And you have to clean up, and you don't really want them all over the lot. They can damage the other cars. So the idea,
you have to feed them.
The early money was somebody, probably more than one, said, "Ooh, this is pretty. I can carry this. Do you like this?"
And there's not much of it.
There's not a lot of it. Do you like it? Yeah, I like that. I'll give you my chicken for that thing. Cowrie shells, flint blanks.
Cowrie shells. I like that.
Yeah. Flint blanks, salt. These were all things that were used for money early on. Salt was not necessarily a good form of money because you could eat it. You cooked with it and so on. So it's nice.
People consume their money now.
Well, we have a less consumer-based economy than we did when people had to be worth their salt. That's where that term comes from, by the way. Old veterans are salty, not because of sweat. It's a Latin thing for when the troops were paid in salt, literally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And salt was rare and expensive. But then we graduated, since we're on the subject of money. I love the subject money. And money then graduated from being something rare and solid, known as specie, gold, silver, things of that nature,
and copper,
zinc. The origin of the dollar is the Austrian Thaler, because they had a mine in Austria at Thaler where they could mine pure silver. Most silver is in ore format. So when you get, when somebody gets done refining it, it can be of various purity. But there's a couple of places in the world where they found veins of solid silver, and they just simply had to take the silver, melt it down, put it in a mold, and it became a thaler, or sterling, as the case may be, in Scotland.
Athens, the Athenians had a mine that actually allowed them to beat the Spartans in their war. Even though the Spartans had a much better military, the Athenians had a silver mine that they could use to buy a big fleet and sail away while the Spartans burned down their city, and then come back to it and eventually outlast them because they had more money.
It's really important to understand that we've graduated from that. Mentally and emotionally, I think most of us still think of money as specie, as gold. And for instance, if the United States only has a certain amount of gold at Fort Knox and in New York and wherever we keep our gold, that's all the money we can print, because otherwise the money isn't worth anything. Well, it's really not true anymore. The Romans pioneered a concept of using non-precious metals in their coins, and they printed the emperor's face on them. And that is what made them valuable, because it was very, very illegal. Like, you get hung or chopped in half or something immediately for faking the emperor's money. So counterfeiting was very much frowned upon, and a lot of people died for trying to do it. So the money became valuable simply because the Romans said it was valuable and they would back it.
Now, and at the same time, the word money comes from Juno Moneta, which was there was a temple on Mons Juno, one of the seven hills in Rome, the temple to Juno, Juno Moneta specifically, where you would go and put your money on deposit. It was sort of like a bank.
And that's where they printed it.
Yeah.
That's where they
minted the money there. It was a religious experience.
It was. And it was very carefully controlled how much of it there was out there. And it became something completely different. And we have another question, but we could go for an entire book on this subject.
It's absolutely fascinating, because until we shifted from this is a weighty object that everyone can agree that we all like it, whether that's a shell, a piece of, chunk of salt, or a piece of metal that's rare. Then it became based on, I promise you that I have that metal on deposit at another bank. It became based on a promise, a word, a bond. That's where we get a loan being a bond, is that you are promising to pay it back, or you are promising that you have it on deposit when it's issued so that it can be spent. So anyway, we've covered, I think we could keep talking on that subject for a long time, but we've got another question. So John's question, Inquisitor John, it's an article about bear markets. And it says, intelligent investors don't bother trying to predict the unpredictable. They focus on controlling the controllable.
Right.
His question is, what does the personal wealth coach see as the controllable? And you made when I was reading this back and talking with you or before the program started, you went, oh, I like that question. So I'll let you take it first.
What you can control, John, and everyone else, is yourself. That's it in a nutshell. People damage themselves in bear markets during the bear markets by selling out at low prices. People have preceded that damage in many cases, though, during the bull market by not having enough reserve because they don't recognize that a bear market is going to come. It's really important when you invest to recognize that thing that you see in mutual fund advertisements and so on that says share prices may be higher or lower when purchased than when redeemed, which doesn't mean a lot to most people, but the reality is, if we look back at the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index in 2000 through 2002, it dropped 50%. If we look at 1987, in a very short period of time, it dropped over 30%. If we look at 2007 through the mid-2009, it dropped about 50%. These things happen. Can you control them? No, they're going to happen. So what you do is control what can be controlled, which is say, I can control the fact that where I get my money during a bear market.
You can diversify across the marketplace beforehand. That's something you don't have a lot of control of it during the bear market unless you did it before.
And not only diversify, you can say, if I'm drawing from my 401k portfolio or IRA or whatever for retirement, or I'm going to in the next few years, I have enough reserves to last through an average or even above average bear market. We look at history and say, how long do bear markets typically last historically? And you say, well, yeah, but you can't predict the future. No, you can't predict the future. But we can say, for example, winter is coming, and without having an entire TV series on it.
Right.
And you can say summer is coming. I live in Salado. I can say a flood is coming.
And summer's already here. I'm just letting you know that.
Yeah, and summer is here. I can forecast in the wintertime that summer is coming. And by the way, it's a lot easier to get the air conditioning people to come and examine your air conditioning system in the wintertime than it is in the summertime. I've noticed this.
Yeah.
I've got a stack of wood under in my carport because winter's coming.
But don't you know it's the middle of summer? You don't need that wood.
Yeah, that's exactly it. The point is, those things you can control well. Can you control when a bear market's going to hit? No. Can you control when it's over? No. Do you know when it's going to be over? No. What you can say is, historically, here's what we've seen. And based on that, I can control a lot about my finances.
Right. So I think that kind of bridges over into what that next question is going to be next hour. It's about Social Security and whether or not Congress is going to lower current recipients' payments in 2035 or limit what people receive that haven't started it yet. And we'll talk about that next hour.
I'd like to throw one comment about that for next hour.
Quick.
Congress doesn't have to do anything to lower
right.
recipients' income.
Right.
It'll automatically go down 80% if Congress does nothing.
So we'll talk right. about that right. more.
Not 80%, 20%.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more next hour because there's a lot of stuff that may happen over the next 13 years. But in the meantime, if you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have emails, phone numbers available. We'll get you to the emails in a minute. They're the same ones that we just gave you before. Local voicemail during the weekends, real live people during the week is
254-947-1111
or 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com if you're lazier like me. There are newsletters to read there. You can also sign up to receive them directly to your email. There are recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. You can go anywhere podcasts are provided and find us there as well. Let's see, email to us or contact form on the webpage is jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.